Mr. Sykes.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Tom Sykes appearing for the appellant, Simco Investors. The District Court's opinion reflects five obvious errors, both substantive and procedural, errors that the IRS does not dispute. We respectfully suggest that it's important to Simco, not to mention tax practitioners, that this Court not leave this opinion intact. While more could be said about these undisputed errors, I'll now move directly to the issues that remain in dispute. Simco's motion for summary judgment should have been granted because of the rule of Roberts v. Commissioner. The case holds that if the IRS fails to challenge a partnership's return, the return is accepted as filed. That is, Roberts holds that if the IRS fails to issue a notice of final partnership administrative adjustment, an FPA, challenging a partnership's reporting, a, quote, determination, end quote, is made and the items on the return are correctly reported. The goal of the special partnership audit procedures set out in the Internal Revenue Code is to ensure consistency with respect to how partnership items are reported on the returns of both partners and partnerships. A determination is the basic mechanism for obtaining this cross-return consistency. A determination is made in several ways. If the IRS does not challenge a partnership's return, the items are determined as originally reported. That's what happened with respect to the items on the return of CIP, the other partnership involved here. A second scenario is that the IRS issues an FPA challenging the return and the partnership fails to bring a suit challenging the FPA. In that case, the FPA's adjustments become a determination. A third scenario.
Where does this supposed rule of Roberts against the commissioner come from?
I think it has a statutory origin, Your Honor. Determination is kind of the core concept that is set out in the code.
Counsel, what statute? It says it has a statutory origin. What statute?
6221 et sec is...
et sec is not a statute. Is there some statute you rely on?
It would be cited in Roberts, and I can't tell you off the top of my head.
The reason I ask this is because this argument seems to me functionally identical, if not absolutely identical, to the argument that was made and rejected in United States against Fior d'Italia. And as between Roberts, a tax court decision, and Fior d'Italia, a decision of the Supreme Court of the United States, it's perfectly clear which one we follow.
I'm sorry, but I haven't, I'm not acquainted with Fior d'Italia. I'll just have to admit that.
Okay.
That's all I can say, Your Honor. I view a determination as similar to a preclusion generated by the doctrine of collateral estoppel. And again, I don't know what Fior d'Italia says, so I can't really respond. But it seems to me that the whole idea behind the procedure set out in 6221 et sec is for there to be consistency across partnerships returns and partners returns.
That's exactly the argument that was made in Fior d'Italia.
Okay, well, I
persuaded the Ninth Circuit. The Supreme Court reversed them 9-0.
Okay, well, I can't say any more than that. It was not a case that was cited by the court below. It wasn't cited by the government in any of its briefs. I'm not familiar with it, so I really can't say any more than that. I would like to speak about the reg, which was core to both the government's argument below and to the argument made by DOJ here. And that is the court below said that this reg provided the basis for overruling the carryover basis chain, if you will. There's a chain that runs from the first partnership, CIP, to Simco. The first link in the chain is Roberts. The second two links are 723 and 732B. And by the way, the government doesn't really attack Roberts. On brief, the government never mentions Roberts. The court below never mentioned Roberts. The court below, we relied heavily on Roberts, but really no one has ever discussed it. But the government's argument is focused on 723. In footnote 27 of the government's brief, they say that this reg trumps, is contrary to, is actually the phrase they use, is contrary to 723. So basically they are saying, as I understand it, that the weak link in the chain is 723. But again, that's a statute which cannot be trumped by regulation. We submit that the regulation ought to be read in harmony with the Roberts and the rest. The regulation surely can.
Counsel, citing a decision of the tax court is like citing a decision of a magistrate judge. It has zero precedential effect. It has zero authoritative effect. If there is some statute that the tax court was construing, by all means, let's talk about the statute.
Again, Your Honor, it's construing the statute that refers to determinations, and that is a concept that crops up over and over in this series of statutes. And, you know, unfortunately, I hadn't focused on the Supreme Court case, and no one else had either. But this all stems from what does it mean for there to be a determination. A determination is really the core concept of the whole regime. The reg that the government relies on should be read in a manner that is consistent with other competing considerations. The reg has to give way to 723. The reg can easily be harmonized. The reg says that it's an illustration, quote unquote. It's set out in parentheses. It says, it uses the phrase such as, which indicates that the reg is giving an example. It's not stating a comprehensive rule. And accordingly, we think the reg is too thin a reed for the government to hang its hat on. And again, the government has never challenged Roberts, doesn't have a word to say about Roberts, never has, neither has the court below. Together, those two, the government's brief ran to 74 pages, and the opinion below ran to 20 pages, 94 pages without any mention of Roberts, which was our key case. I'd like
when
to use
your
a...
Client,
pardon?
When was your client made aware of the notice of this change?
This happened in late 04, Your Honor. You're talking about the FPAW? The FPAW was issued in September of 04. We filed suit within 90 days, or basically right at the 90th day. We filed suit in December of 04.
But was it already in effect? Was this transaction? Because the Klamath case went...
Well, that came out
because it was it was put together before the notice came down.
Well, we've got a couple of different notices that are at play in this case. One is notice 2000-44 issued by the IRS in August of 2000, and that is it's basically a press release where the IRS says we disagree with a transaction, we're going to challenge it, and the transactions here that are at issue occurred in December of 2000. Now, the IRS had dithered over the legal rules that apply, the tax rules, the substantive tax rules. In 1975, the government started taking the position, and successfully so, in a case called Helmer. And as the opinion below recognizes, the government successfully urged upon the courts for 20 to 25 years the idea that contingent liabilities are not taken into account. In 1995, we have evidence of the IRS's internal deliberations. In 1995, the chief counsel, that is the IRS's top lawyer, is in meetings deliberating over the Helmer rule and whether it's really a good thing. It's a double-edged rule, you see, Your Honor. It provided a powerful weapon to the IRS when it was trying to tax transactions, but at the same time, taxpayers, if they sufficiently appreciated the rule, could use it and turn it against the IRS. And by 1995, 20 years after the IRS first rolled out this rule in litigation, the IRS began to have second thoughts. And there were deliberations in 95 in which the chief counsel actually, during the deliberations, said he tended to agree with the rule. The Treasury Department appears to have weighed in. The notes are a bit cryptic, but the Treasury Department, which actually issues regs, not the IRS, but the Treasury Department, said that it believed that a reg would be necessary to overrule the 20-year-old rule developed in the courts. IRS then dithered for 8 years. They didn't come out with a reg until 2003.
Why?
We don't know.
If the it's the same as Roberts. If the tax court bungles the job, that doesn't make a nationwide rule that's binding on everybody.
Your Honor, it's far more than the tax court. There's a whole series of cases, and Helmer was the origin. That was the first case, but there were a lot of other cases that followed the Helmer rule, and that was the reason for the court below to conclude that in 2000 the law supported CIP's position as to the basis issue that is at the core of the merits of this case. Now, we've got various procedural arguments, of course, that are up front here, but such as the FPA preclusion argument, which the Chief Judge and I have been discussing, but the merits rule is one on which the IRS dithered for 28 years, running from 1975 to 2003. Our transaction was done in December of 2000. A reg comes out 2.5 years later, which purports to reach back almost 4 years, and says this transaction is invalid. And so a big piece of our brief, Your Honor, is devoted to the proposition that it was an abuse of discretion for that retroactive reg to be issued. The IRS, you know, wants it both ways. For years and years, it adheres to a rule, and then at some point it wakes up, can't decide what to do, and waits 8 years to issue a reg. And we would submit that that is an abuse of discretion. And we also submit that the Treasury Department in 1995, when it viewed regs as necessary to overturn the rule, we agree with that. Regs were necessary. But in 2003, when it made them retroactive, but in December of 2000, when these transactions were done, there was no hint that regs were on the horizon.
Are lots of these in litigation somewhere?
Yes, there are other cases like this, and I can't tell you how many or where. The government's attorney is here. And
is this ahead of the others or what?
Yes. There's one in the Court of Federal Claims that I know of, and I'm sure Mr. Catterall, DOJ's attorney, can tell you more about the other cases that are pending. But one that I'm aware of is known as Jade Trading, and that, in fact, discovery in that case is what unearthed the 1995 internal IRS deliberations. So I've kind of jumped ahead, Your Honor, to the retroactivity issue, but we submit that this notice that you referred to issued in August of 2000, it provided no notice. It didn't mention future regulations. It didn't mention that those future regulations would be retroactive. We don't think that the notice issued in August of 2000 gave warning of the regulation. It didn't give a warning of the regulations that were to come almost 3 years later.
Were your clients aware of it?
Of the notice?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was published by the IRS, yes.
But it had to be something they knew about before entering.
It was widely, right. It was widely published, yes, Your Honor. Going back, Your Honor, to the FPA preclusion argument, I call it. I want to emphasize that I think it operates like a collateral estoppel, Your Honor. And it's a double-edged rule. This procedural rule under Roberts is a double-edged rule. The IRS, I think one can be sure, if they had been in a situation where the earlier partnership had not challenged a determination. Let's say that CIP here had been issued an FPA, which they weren't, and that's the problem. But let's say that CIP had been issued an FPA, failed or refused to respond to it. Surely the IRS would be arguing that that gives rise to a preclusive binding determination that had to be carried over. And again, we have a carryover from one partnership to Semco, our taxpayer, by way of three links. Roberts is the first link, which establishes the basis. Then we've got these two statutes, 723 and 732, which require a carryover to our partnership. And the government attacks the 723 link in that chain with the regulation, but a regulation cannot trump the statute. We also raised, Your Honor, the government's motion below was based strictly on a novel argument that the government, that the taxpayer had failed to plead legal theories in its complaint. In this case, the court below didn't address that argument, but there's no authority for the proposition that we had to plead legal theories. We expressly contested the idea that there was that the loss adjustment was valid, and we cannot be viewed as conceding an item that we expressly contested. Finally, we of course did raise the issue about the valuation misstatement penalty. We think that that penalty statute is not clear on its face. Parentheses were inserted in 1989 in a revision. The parentheses indicate that there is a subordinate relationship between the valuation element of the statute and the adjusted basis element of the statute. And there are questions, therefore, that are raised by just looking at the face of the statute. The government's position would subject millions of everyday transactions to the valuation misstatement penalty. It would, for example, encompass, if the government's position were upheld, transactions in which a sale of stock is sold and somehow basis or adjusted basis is misreported. It would also, with respect to the sale of a residence, it would scoop up that. The government argues that this penalty is somehow just a weapon against tax shelters. It likes to invoke tax shelters, some kind of mantra that it thinks should be an answer to every analytical question. But this valuation statement penalty, as construed by the government, would encompass millions and millions of everyday transactions, and it shouldn't be construed broadly the way they want it. Instead, we've got a Supreme Court case which says that it is to be strictly construed against the government. And
how much money is in this penalty?
The amount for the year we've got in suit is 40% of the tax. It's an enhanced penalty. That's why it bothers us.
Well, I just wondered if you have a number.
It would be 40% of $40,000 in this year. There are effects on other years, but it boosts the tax by 40%. The government, in its brief, spent time on a case called Twombly, decided by, going back to the pleadings issue, decided by the Supreme Court after all of these pleadings were submitted in this case. That case is a antitrust conspiracy case, and the U.S. Supreme Court did say that there has to be some reason to view the case as being entitled to go forward. Well, our district judge here already determined that this case should go forward. She reached the FPA preclusion argument, and she reached the valuation penalty argument. She sua sponte raised the argument with respect to the retroactivity of the regs. The judge viewed the pleadings as sufficient to allow the case to go forward. For all of these reasons, we respectfully submit that the taxpayer's motion for summary judgment should be granted and the decision below should be vacated. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Sykes. Mr. Catterall.
May it please please the court. My name is Arthur Catterall with the Justice Department, representing the United States in this appeal. First, I'd like to talk about the Roberts case a little bit and why we did not cite that case. We did not cite that case because we didn't think it was relevant. And you ask what the statute is that Roberts purported to be addressing. The basic statutory rule is I believe in 6225A, which basically says that the IRS, when it comes to partnership items, the IRS cannot adjust the return of a partner without first adjusting the return of a partnership. It's a partnership partner rule. And the
which statute is this again?
I believe it's 6225A.
6225A.
Yes.
That's more helpful than Roberts itself, which, so far as I can see, and I've just read it, cites nothing whatsoever.
Well, and Roberts just reiterates what 6225A says. In other words, the corollary to Section 6225A is that if, for whatever reason, the IRS is precluded from adjusting the partnership's return, then it cannot go after the partners to adjust that partnership item on their return. And Simcoe has taken this language and as counsel says, has interpreted it to basically establish a rule of collateral estoppel. In other words, not only is a partnership determination or a proceeding or a lack of a proceeding final for purposes of the partner's return, it's final for all purposes. So even if this, as we have in this case, if this item shows up on another partnership's return, then according to Simcoe, the Roberts court would say, no, you're subject to at least a rule that's functionally similar to collateral estoppel. And again, the statute says nothing about binding, a partnership determination being binding on a separate partnership, unless that second partnership is itself a partner of the first partnership. So there's just no basis in the statute or the regulations to broaden this language in Roberts to have this, this preclusive effect across partnerships. Again, going back to the collateral estoppel analogy, I think it's fairly clear that the collateral estoppel principles apply to issues that have been fully and fairly litigated, not to an administrative decision, not to pursue administrative action. And I think an analogy is, if someone's taking a return position year after year after year, the IRS audits them year after year after year, and only in year five they decide, well, we really don't like this, we're gonna disallow it. I don't think counsel would argue that the taxpayer in that situation could say, you let us slide for years one and four, so you're collaterally estopped. It's just the principles of collateral estoppel just don't work that way. They apply to litigated issues. Counsel suggested that if the shoe were on the other foot, if the IRS had issued an FPOT, a CIP, and CIP had just rolled over, then counsel suggests that surely the IRS would say that CIP's concession is binding on Simcoe, And I disagree completely with that, because again, the determination of a partnership item is binding with respect to the partners of that partnership, but not across partnerships. And I think that may be one reason why the IRS did not issue an FPA to CIP. Other, you know, aside from the fact.
Issue a what?
I'm sorry. An FPA is a notice of.
Use English. We would much appreciate it.
How about a notice of adjustment?
That would be comprehensible.
Actually, I lost my train of thought. At any rate.
Would before 1995 or whatever, would this transaction have been okay?
No.
When does it not be okay? As you can tell, I'm sort of wondering about retroactivity and when this kind of a transaction was perfectly legal versus when the IRS no longer tolerated it.
We have to draw a little bit of a distinction between the technical application of the Section 752 rules regarding, you know, is a contingent liability taken into account for purposes of 752. That's sort of a technical issue, and prior to the retroactive effective date of these new regulations, the answer to that question, the case law supported the position that Section 752 did not apply to contingent obligations. That does not mean that principles of economic substance just fall by the wayside. Even if you, comply with the letter of the law, if you use the statutory provision to create a completely artificial loss in economic terms,
you call that an abuse, I presume.
Absolutely. So these cases, Helmer, and there's two or three others after it. They were nothing like that. I mean, there was the technical issue of how do you apply Section 752, but they did not involve these abusive offsetting digital options that create completely artificial losses from an economic standpoint. So those cases simply didn't have the occasion to apply economic substance principles. So regardless of the fact that the regulation may have changed the technical application of the rule, economic substance principles, go back to Gregory versus Helveringer, 1930s, and to suggest that technical compliance with these basis rules trumps economic substance, we think is completely unfounded.
I guess you're saying this would be an abuse under any circumstance, or at least challengeable for that, regardless of what the new regulation is.
Right. And absolutely. I mean, the regulation just makes it a lot easier for the IRS to stamp out these abuses, because you've got something, in black and white you can point to, a mechanical rule, a basis reduction rule. Without such a rule, you're likely to have a long, drawn-out trial about, economic substance, which is, for the most part, inherently a factual issue. But definitely, even without regard to the regulation, there's no way that this loss survives the economic substance doctrine. So it's just a question of whether the IRS wins now or wins later. And in that regard,
I was going to ask you, there's similar transactions before the courts now, both before and after the regulation, whatever you want to call it, transactions before and after the regulation.
I'm sorry, could you repeat?
Is there current litigation from your department now for this type of a transaction, both before and after the regulation?
Well,
cases out there.
Well, I can tell you that there was a case called Coltech Industries, I believe, as Federal Circuit, and it involved basically the same type of arrangement, but in the corporate context. And the transaction occurred before the anti-abuse rule in Section 358H snuffed out these kind of transactions. So the IRS could not rely on that. The IRS had to argue economic substance. And, the taxpayers said, you know, we complied with steps 1, 2, and 3 of the rules. We are within the letter of the law. So automatically we win. And the Federal Circuit agreed. It said, you did comply with the statute. You're right. Nonetheless, you lose because there's your loss is completely fictional. The economic substance principles trump just mechanical compliance with the tax rules.
Why would this retroactive aspect be valid?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. First, in Section 7805B6 specifically authorizes the IRS to issue retroactive regulations pursuant to a grant of congressional authority. And as I mentioned when I was talking about the Coltech case, there's a parallel abuse in the corporate world that was taken care of by statute in 2000, Section 358H. And the enacting provision, I believe Section 309D, specifically authorizes the IRS to issue similar rules relating to partnerships and specifically authorizes that those regulations be retroactive to, I believe, October 19th of 1999, which is when there's the first committee consideration of this rule. So there's the grant of specific authority to make the regulation retroactive.
And what about the notice aspect?
I'm sorry, when you say what about the notice aspect?
That was the issue. Your opponent was saying that they didn't have notice of the retroactivity.
Well, we would suggest that they did have notice by reason of this provision in the 2000 Tax Act that specifically said, it created a rule in the corporate context. And again, the enacting provision specifically said, IRS, please take care of this problem by regulations in the realm of partnerships. And if you want to, you can make those regulations retroactive to October 19th, 1999. So that's one bit of notice. The other provision that we rely on as far as the retroactivity of the regulations is Section 7805B3, which is a broad grant to the IRS that the IRS can issue retroactive regulations to prevent abuse. And, under any reasonable definition of abuse, these kind of transactions are abusive. There's just no dispute that the loss is completely artificial from an economic standpoint. So that's two separate areas of notice. And then when Notice 2000-44 came out, counsel indicates that it did not specifically state that regulations were forthcoming, but it certainly put people on fair notice that this kind of transaction is abusive. The IRS is, clearly on record as saying this is abusive. And under 7805B3, clearly the IRS can issue retroactive regulations to prevent abuse. So we submit that the regulations are, the retroactive feature of the regulations is completely valid.
I assume this manufactured loss was supposed to offset some, I guess, gain from somewhere else, right?
Yes, yes.
And I don't understand this whole thing, frankly, but I assume that's why they tried to carry forward with this loss to offset other income from someplace else.
Right. Certain law firms and certain accounting firms basically started marketing these types of arrangements to very high net wealth individuals to shelter their income. We talked somewhat about the Klamath case in the Eastern District of Texas. I know that the taxpayers in that case were basically the lead trial attorneys in the Texas, tobacco litigation. So they just had gazillions of attorney's fees to shelter. This transaction is not quite on that scale, but it's the same idea. You've got people with a whole lot of income that they don't want to pay tax on. So that's what, and that's the sole purpose. There's no kind of investment objective or. It's purely a tax dodge. There's another one thing I'd like to address. Counsel drew attention to footnote 27 in our brief, and says and interprets the government interprets that footnote as saying that the government's position is that this regulation regarding partnership items somehow trumps the statutory basis rules, and that's clearly not what we said. What we said is that Simcoe's interpretation of the basis rules conflicts with this regulation. So we're certainly not saying that this regulation regarding that regarding the fact that a partnership has to independently determine the basis of property contributed to it. It can't just rely on the contributor's statement, hey, I'm contributing property and it's got a basis of $40 million. The regulation says that a partnership has to make the is not allowed to just take it on faith, has to investigate, make a determination as to what the contribution, I'm sorry, what the basis of the contributed property was. So just wanted to point out that we're not saying that a regulation trumps a statute. I'll jump now to the valuation misstatement penalty issue. And One point that counsel makes is that if you include basis misstatements, you're just going to capture all sorts of mom and pop everyday transactions. You sell a share of stock, you sell your house, boom, you're subject to this huge penalty. Well, the penalty doesn't apply unless you've overstated your basis by 200% to 400%, or at least at the time this case, I believe now the threshold is 150% to 200%. But in other words, the everyday person selling their house is not going to overstate their basis by 150% to 200%. So I don't think that including basis misstatements is going to just capture all these everyday transactions. So just quickly, would like to address one thing that Simcoe said in his reply brief. Simcoe suggests that the IRS can, if indeed we need to get to the economic substance of the transaction, somehow the IRS has basically waived that issue because we failed to cross appeal a complete victory in the district court. The government can't cross appeal unless it's been harmed or aggrieved by the judgment. Simcoe tries to say that, well, the district court really did kind of reject economic substance, and it just didn't. So with that, we'd urge the court to affirm the district court's judgment in all respects.
Federal. Anything further, Mr. Sykes? That's for sure. I think you have about 30 seconds.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I think the statute the court is looking for is 6222A, which requires consistency between the returns of partners and partnerships. And that is what required the partner to use the basis that was found in CIP. Secondly, with regard to economic substance, that is a fact-bound issue, and that is an issue that the court has never reached below. We dispute that there was no profit motive, and if anyone wants to get into that issue, there would have to be a remand on that. With regard to collateral estoppel, we aren't dealing with a situation where you've got litigation over something that occurred 4 years ago. These were transactions that all occurred as that were related, obviously, both in time and in actual connection. The statute, the 2000 Tax Act, which counsel mentioned, was enacted on December 21. Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.